Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
Sugar man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary Jane. Sugar man met a false friend on a lonely, dusty road.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Pod Shots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are talking the 2012 documentary Searching for Sugarman. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest Mr. Steve Bruns.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. So, Steve, before getting into our first sort of our first documentary actually on this show, it's drink roll call time. So, what do you got for me?
I got myself my favorite Belgian brew. I've got myself some Stella.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, this is something that I enjoy. I had some on the Super Bowl party that I attended last week, and I got some leftovers, so I'm polishing it off.
Very nice. I'm trying something a little different. It's a beer, so it's not too fancy, but it's called Henry Weinard's, I guess. It's a Henry Weinard's, and then it's a Private Reserve Northwestern style lager. Uh-huh. I've never heard of this before, so we'll see how it goes. It's a Blitz Weinard Brewing Company from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh, it's closer to my neck of the woods.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think it was on sale or something today, and I picked her up and thought I'd give her a whirl, so I haven't actually dug into it yet, but I guess we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, let me know.
Yeah, so with that, let's kick off our discussion of Searching for Sugarman, or Sugarman, however you want to say it.
If ever there is an air of intrigue and mystery around a pop artist, it is around the artist known as Rodriguez.
We thought he was like the inner city poet.
He was this wandering spirit around the city.
He's like a wise man, a prophet.
How many records do you think he sold in America?
In America, 6.
Born in a troubled city.
Well, it's still a bit of a mystery how the first copy of Cold Fact actually came to South Africa, but it spread very quickly. To many of us South Africans, he was the soundtrack to our lives.
Everybody I knew had his records.
The message it had was be anti-establishment. Really, the first opposition to apartheid, they'll tell you that they were influenced by Rodriguez.
But nobody knew anything about him. He was a mystery.
Then we found out that he had committed suicide.
And a lot of people have different versions of the story.
He set himself alight on stage.
He reached down and pulled up a gun. I thought it'd make a good story. Find out how Rodriguez died.
There was nothing on the record to tell us who he was or where he was from. So we started looking quite deeply at the lyrics.
I met a girl in Dearborn.
We found him, we found him.
These are the days of miracles and wonder.
I heard he did a little construction work.
He was really doing the work that no one else wanted to do. Rich in a lot of things, but perhaps not material things.
I said, in South Africa, you are more popular than Elvis Presley.
Next day, he says, Emerson, I got to go on tour. I said, why is that, Rodriguez?
Is this really going to be Rodriguez? We'll only know if we can actually sing these songs.
And the best part was still to come.
Thanks for keeping me alive.
Okay, so the plot synopsis for this film is in the early 1970s, Sixto Rodriguez was a Detroit folk singer who had a short-lived recording career with only 2 well-received but non-selling albums. Unknown to Rodriguez, his musical story continued in South Africa, where he became a pop music icon and inspiration for generations. Long rumored there to be dead by suicide, a few fans in the 1990s decided to seek out the truth of their hero's fate. What follows is a bizarrely heartening story in which they found far more in their quest than they had ever hoped, while a Detroit construction laborer discovered that his long lost artistic dreams came true after all. And that is from IMDb, and it kind of gives a little bit more away than I wished it would have, and I wished I would have read that beforehand. So anyway, I mean, there at the end, I mean, this, I guess, you know, straight away, this is going to be a spoiler-filled episode, and there is some twists and turns that go on in the film. So if you haven't seen this, it is nominated for an Oscar. It is definitely worthwhile and worth checking out, or else we wouldn't really be talking about it here. But yeah, I kind of wish that they didn't mention that the last section there where it says, while a Detroit construction laborer discovers that his lost artistic dreams came true after all.
Oh, so to understand you correctly, you knew that he was still alive and kicking when you saw the documentary because of that passage?
No, I didn't put that in there until today.
Oh, okay.
I actually knew nothing about this film.
Oh, good. Oh, good. That's the way because I was in the same situation, and that's why I was really anticipating reviewing this with you because of the surprise that comes with this documentary.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I knew that. I mean, you saw this before I did, and we kind of went back and forth on what we were specifically going to do for this episode, but. You know, I kind of like, especially in documentaries, knowing as little as possible, because I feel like that there usually isn't a whole lot of plot. And so if there is a twist and you find out that twist, that can ruin a film. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of times with documentaries, it's you know, it's the process and getting there and all that kind of thing. But this one, I feel like if you know sort of the last half of the film, it doesn't have as much impact as if you go into it blind, kind of like what you and I did, Steve. So again, I implore people, if you have not seen this, you know, press pause, go see it, and then come back later and listen to the rest of the episode. So did you, I guess before getting into this, what's, are you, I'm leading this, even though I know the answer. Are you a big a documentary fan, Steve?
Oh, I am. Absolutely. I probably have seen in the last 2 weeks half a dozen documentaries, and most of them are the ones that are nominated for the Oscars coming up, including this one that we're speaking about today.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm a huge documentary film fan. However, I'm not really a huge music fan to the extent of, like, I would be really into obscure artists. And even though the subject of this documentary is about music, and kind of at first I thought I'd be less excited about what I was about to see,
mm-hmm.
Even though I'm not much of a music head, this really, this film spoke to me in a way that I didn't expect.
Yeah, you know, I really enjoy documentaries as well. I find that for me, documentaries are the hardest for me to talk about. And I feel that way, I think, because it's a lot easier for me to criticize a person if it's a fictionalized version of someone. And so if it's a real person, it's tough for me to say, oh, this performance wasn't good, or, oh, this writing was bad, or, you know, or there's not typically a lot of behind the scenes, like, directorial style. I mean, there can be some directorial style, but there's not really a lot of how do I want to say it? There's not a lot of, like, you know, writing per se, and there's not a lot of traditional Hollywood about it.
Mm-hmm.
In comparison to a regular film. And so that's what I have a little bit of trouble talking about, even though, you know, I still think there is some artistry involved, and I think that there, you know, you obviously get all this footage and you have to kind of shape a story out of it if there's one that's not naturally there. So I do enjoy documentaries. I kind of I put a lot of them on and watch them while I'm doing something, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's not a lot that I'll sit and, you know, kind of try to pick apart and analyze and that sort of thing. So what I did was I did just watch this and kind of after the fact took some notes down. So my notes are a little bit more sparse than typical in most of the discussions. But so, yeah, so I do enjoy documentaries as well. So getting to this film, then, did you just watch this or check it out because it was nominated for an Oscar? Or had you heard anything about it, or was this kind of like a blind watch, or what was your experience with it?
Well, whenever they release the Oscar nominees, I do go through to see if there's any that, for whatever reason, slip through the Netflix cracks, as I like to call it. I usually do a pretty good job of updating my queue, and I just kind of double-check things when the Oscars came out. And when I saw the nominees for the documentary, there looked like there was about five pretty interesting topics that were going to be covered. And Searching for Sugar Man was among Netflix's recommendations, the highest one recommended for me. You know how they project, you know, what they think you'll think of it. So because of that, I put it right at the top and got it right away. And that's how I ended up viewing it. And I do want to also add on to what you were saying earlier. I totally agree with you about why it can be challenging to evaluate a documentary, because just like those projections I was telling you about on Netflix where it guesses what you think you'll say, mine are always, when it comes to a documentary, between 4 stars and 5, because I so very rarely – you know, I'm critical of documentaries, you know, usually because they're done well, or you can follow up and check the veracity of things. And I guess maybe I have a background in journalism that kind of just draws me to this genre. And I just seem to be someone who just kind of gravitates to these kinds of stories.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I know that I'm kind of the same way. Like, I don't typically just think, oh yeah, that's okay, and forget about it. Like, a documentary, especially if it's well done, will stick with me a little bit longer than most films. The only one that I remember seeing and was just disgusted by was, it's called The Back Nine, and I've talked about it. It's, I guess, almost a year ago now when I talked about this. And it was in my, my best and worst of, 2011. When I did the marathon challenge, and it was one of the worst films that I'd seen during that 400 movie challenge. And it was so bad because it's about a golfer who at 40 decides he's going to join the PGA Tour, or at least try to get to the level of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a average golfer and just says, well, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to just go and join the tour. And I was just so disgusted by that, working in the golf business and knowing like what it takes and how like how much different a player of my capability is compared to a tour player, and then that same distance is how much better I am than this schmo that thinks he's gonna gonna do this. And he just had like this Californian attitude of, oh hey man, it'll be okay, like I'm just gonna do this and it'll be cool. And I was just like, fuck this guy. And so I was so just pissed that he had this. And, you know, there's a scene where he, and we'll actually get to the film here in a second, but there's a scene in this, The Back Nine, where he goes and he plays and it's windy and it's raining and all this, and he shoots like a 85, 86, and he's on this amateur tour, which anyone can join. It's not an exclusive thing. And he's in the amateur tour and he shoots like an 85 or so, and he goes and is kind of like, oh, that wasn't very good. And the wind and the weather gets so bad afterwards, he ends up winning his division, okay, or his flight. Now, for the people that don't know, flight is, you know, you can get flighted based on what you shot, you know, and there, if there's 20 guys and there's 4 flights, it'll be 5 people in each group. Like, it's broken up like that. And so he, in his flight, he got first place, and he didn't win. He didn't shoot the lowest score, but you would have thought he just got, you know, through Q school and was on the tour or something. Like, he was just so proud of himself, and just made the movies made such a big deal out of it. And I just sat there like arms on my head, just like, what are you talking about? Like, this guy is garbage. He's not a good golfer. And they're trying to like drum up the story. And it's, anyway, I could go on and on and on and about how much I don't like that movie. So, but that's not what the movie we're talking about. We were talking about Searching for Sugar Man. So I guess generally, what did you think about this? Like, what did you take away from the film? Like, I know that you had mentioned that you had been listening to some of the songs in particular.
Well, yeah, one of the things that I took away from this film, and it really just goes along with what you said about how long a film can stick with you. After I saw this documentary, it stuck with me for a real long time because I found myself researching him, you know, on Wikipedia, going to iTunes, sampling some of his music. I even went so far as to buy like 3 or 4 songs of his that I really thought were prominently, you know, displayed in the film. And sometimes that's what films do for me. Like I said earlier, I'm not much of a music guy, but I remember I saw this film that was kind of an obscure indie film. I think it was titled something like The Day the Music Stopped or something. And it was the story of a young man who had some rare brain disorder where he stopped knowing who he was. And it was like some kind of a, you know, just debilitating, horrible disease they had no cure for. But ironically, anytime you played music from The Grateful Dead, he was himself again.
Oh, crazy.
His dad ends up being like this big deadhead, and they go to concerts together. And when they were going to these concerts, and those songs that were like really powerful in the movie, I ended up buying like 4 or 5 Grateful Dead songs. So that's usually how I end up updating my like music. It usually is because of music that I heard in a really good show or a really good movie. And because Searching for Sugar Man gave, you know, such a lasting impression, that's why I updated my playlist with about 3 or 4 of his songs.
Did you go with the titular song with Sugar Man?
No, I think the ones I went with were, one was called Searching for Sugar Man, which is what the film is based off of.
Mm-hmm.
One was called Cause. And then
yes, yes, that one is great.
Yeah. And then the other one is called I Wonder.
Yes, that one's really good too.
This riff to it that goes, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah,
because yeah, so that was his big pop song.
Yeah, yeah. I've been rocking, you know, that in my car for the last couple weeks now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're on the same sort of thing. Like, as soon as the movie was over, I went to go tell my wife about it and got onto YouTube on my phone and started playing different tracks from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And started saying, well, what about this? And what about this? What do you think about this song? And she was just like, you know, she's very much a Frank Sinatra, Beach Boys, you know, much older style of music.
Right.
And so she loved it. Like she was like, oh yeah, I really like that. So I really liked the actual music in there too. And what's so strange is, I would think in today's day and age that we would have a fairly good grasp on if there's quality music, I feel like it would be found out eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's so strange that, you know, it took South Africa and this film to sort of reintroduce this singer-songwriter to the United States.
Yes, and that's one thing that I would be curious to know about. Like, let's say hypothetically this film wins the Oscar, and then that draws even another, you know, bunch of notoriety to him and his, you know, art. I wonder if it'll just kind of have like a third wind or a fourth wind, and then who knows how, like, maybe he'll end up in like a top 10 list of iTunes like sales for 2013 or something.
Yeah, that, like, would
something like that be cool?
That would be crazy. And one of the things that I really like about it is, you know, they describe him a few times as being I think they describe him a little bit as he's called the inner city poet.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's in Detroit and all that, but he's got some like Bob Dylan to him, in the way that his songwriting is more poetry than it is lyrical, because except for a few songs, like I Wonder, a lot of them aren't real, aren't real melodic, or they don't have a real repeating chorus, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. And so I feel like that is what I really like about it, that it seems like he is just singing his poetry. Like, he's an actual artist, I feel like. It's not this cobbled together machine of an image and a voice and songs all, you know, put together by separate people. And then you have this, you know, this thing, this, you know, Carly Rae Jepsen or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. like this pop image. So I just kind of like that it's just this guy who's down on his luck, and he's just, you know, he sings, and he's a really good singer. That was the thing I was really surprised about too. was when I was describing this to my wife, I said, you know, it's like Bob Dylan, but if Bob Dylan could actually sing, you know, because I think Bob Dylan is a good songwriter. I mean, obviously, but I don't know that he's much of a singer, really.
Yeah. Exceptional voice. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, okay. So one of the other things that I wanted to bring up right at the beginning is I like that this film very much keeps you guessing. And I love the fact that you didn't blow this for me.
Yeah. Because you were texting me as you were watching it. I just kept saying, stick with it, my friend.
Yeah. Cause I said, I'm looking at the message right now, and it says, I'm watching Sugar Man now. And you said, hope you liked it, you know. And I said, just started it, gruesome suicide, because they described the suicide at the beginning of Rodriguez, who had, you know, supposedly killed himself at the beginning by dousing himself with gasoline and setting himself on fire. And all you put is, enjoy the ride, and a little smiley face.
Yeah.
And so I was like, huh, that's kind of interesting. Like, you know, instead of oh, yeah, that's too bad he died that way. Or, you know, I was like, that's kind of an interesting way that he chose to do that. And so I was like, I wonder what that is about.
Yeah, and then it turned out to be just like one of those urban legends. And that's what really, I think, makes this documentary stand out was what it did so well was almost like a fictional story does, is it had almost like a M. Night Shyamalan twist on it. But, you know, like I said, this is real. Mm. And the viewer gets a huge payoff to discover that despite these rumors of his apparent drug overdose or suicide because he just kind of up and disappeared after his two records failed, it turns out that this guy is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And just the way that the investigator or the journalist ended up getting a hold of his daughter and he asked basically a question like, so whatever, you know, what happened to your father? And she's like, well, what do you mean? I just saw him yesterday. He just, you know,
yeah,
came over for dinner or whatever. And the guy's like, what? He's still alive? We have got to get in touch with him. Please, you know, give him my number. And then the way that he explains that the phone rings at his South African residence at 1 a.m. and his wife picks up and points to the phone and kind of like mimes that it's him.
Mm-hmm.
And he could tell right from the first word because his voice is the absolute same, you know, distinct, you know, lyrical voice that he uses in his songs.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the fact that, you know, that Rodriguez was so mysterious, like that, you know, I feel like that's something that the sort of the world of Twitter and Facebook and, you know, and all that kind of thing, Google doesn't really have a lot of mystery about things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like everything is so hyped and you're prepared for everything, I feel like.
I know. And I heard that his story was on 60 Minutes. And I would say that I catch about half of the episodes on 60 Minutes, you know, depending what's going on with football or whatnot. And apparently there was a 60 Minutes about this very story. I'm so glad I missed that one. Because that way I could see this documentary fresh without knowing the real story of him. And I have a lot of friends who are huge music, like, aficionados. And, you know, there are these people that I know who, like, go to concerts, you know, 4 or 5 times a week. You know, all they do is invest in songs and, you know, their money is always going to different, you know, downloads and tracks and whatnot. And the two people who I know who are like that, I contacted both of them independently and asked them, have you ever heard of Rodriguez? And neither one of them knew who I was talking about.
Hmm.
And I basically, in all caps, wrote, you have got to see this music documentary called Searching for Sugar Man, because, you know, as somebody who's into music, this should be right up your alley. I mean, I'm not really even into music that much, and this was such an interesting film to me.
Right. Yeah. And I do like the fact that going with the whole mystery thing was that, you know, on his album, there is not any information about him and he's sitting cross-legged and he's got the sunglasses and the hat and he's just kind of this unknowable figure. And when they describe him at the beginning, when he was, you know, singing in those smoky bars to where he wouldn't face the crowd and you couldn't see him and you didn't know where the voice was coming from. And that sort of made you pay attention to the lyrics more than you might I just really enjoy that whole, like, it's about the music, it's not about the man kind of a thing.
Yeah, and you could tell that the film director tried to follow the storyline about, you know, what happened to all those royalties based on the sales of million records in South Africa. And it, even when he's discovered to be alive, because we've discovered that he's this, you know, graduate of philosophy from Wayne State who really has no interest in material things whatsoever, it doesn't seem like he could care any less about money or who ended up getting the royalties, when it's clear that that one gentleman who was interviewed was quite defensive about it.
Charles Avant, yeah.
Probably knows quite, you know, clearly what happened to all those royalties.
Yeah, well, what was interesting about that is, you know, they talk about, they go into the fact that he was huge in South Africa, and they talk about how he was bigger than Elvis and bigger than Rolling Stones, and you know, just to try to wrap my brain around that, I'm like, holy shit, like, that's, you know, that's very famous. That's not just like music famous. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just pop culture, you know, reference famous. And I think that that's really interesting. And then when you go to Charles Avant, who is the producer, I believe.
Yeah, he produced
or the record label,
two of his albums. And he, you know, when he was being interviewed, he said that he was the best artist that he had ever worked with. And it gave a list of like five other artists, like Marvin Gaye or others.
And Michael Jackson, yeah.
Yeah. And but then, of course, when the journalist was interviewing him and really was pressing him on, well, whatever happened to, you know, the money, like, where were you sending it? He's like, well, I don't know what you mean by that. You know, he got real defensive, and he's like, all I had is some address, and there was no, like, next of kin or anything, so I just did what I did, and he just wanted to change the subject.
Yeah, and then they have a little, like, kind of outtake thing where, you know, how many records did he sold? And they tell him that he sold 500,000 in South Africa. And he goes, you think anyone's going to give a fuck about half a million records? And I'm like, wow, the fucking music industry's horrible. Like, this guy's a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really like that. And I think that, you know, when you think about it, though, that's probably the way it is, because he was saying, you know, he had different offshoots that had offshoots that were bootlegging and selling and just doing all this different kind of stuff, to where it was really hard for them to track down who it was that was the distributor, the producer, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then when it gets back to him, and he is such a big deal with the likes of Marvin Gaye and Michael Jackson, to where 500,000 records is still not a big deal to him.
Yeah.
You know, and so I just think that, you know, he's so huge in South Africa that he's just, oh, really? You sold that many? Like, who gives a shit? Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I really like that. One of the things that I thought that was interesting that they get into a little bit, and it's something that I know embarrassingly little about, was how Rodriguez affected the apartheid and the government in South Africa and all of that sort of stuff. Like, I'm so blind when it comes to historical, you know, governmental issues in other countries. And so when they were talking about how they, you know, they had his album on the banned list and they wouldn't allow certain tracks to be played, and then they kind of used that as an anthem to try to convince the government to get rid of apartheid and that kind of thing. Like, I was really taken by that, I guess, because, you know, it wasn't just that this was a popular record or something. You know, it wasn't like he had one hit that was a big thing. It was like a cultural movement that this guy was spearheading and had no idea he was in charge of this or was, you know, taking part in this. And I just found that fascinating, to where, you know, at this point in the film, I don't even believe that they've revealed that he's still alive. And it's just kind of like what this guy meant to this country. Because I just think of, you know, it's too bad that I think of this way, but I think South Africa and I think Nelson Mandela. And that's what I think about it. Right. You know, I know so little about that, the history of that country, that it's I was really enthralled by that section, actually.
Yeah, they say that Bob Dylan was the voice of, like, you know, the 60s anti-Vietnam effort, and they use that comparison to give, you know, Rodriguez's influence to the apartheid movement in South Africa, and I'm kind of with you on that. I mean, I did a little research independent of watching the film after it was over to learn a bit, you know, a little bit about, you know, the timing of things. And then when you put that into my thoughts about remember that Matt Damon movie with Nelson Mandela being played by, like, Morgan Freeman or something?
Oh, where he's a rugby player.
Yeah, what was that called again?
I didn't see it, so I don't know.
Bird or something.
That looked like a real drag, so I don't remember watching that.
Yeah, I did end up watching it, and you're right. They did get a little bit too specific with some of the history, and I think that's probably why it wasn't a well-received, you know, movie in the mainstream. I believe it was a Clint Eastwood, and
yeah,
I'm not a real big fan of his work, quite frankly.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I liked Mystic River. But, I mean, we could spend a whole other show on some of the things that I feel that Clint doesn't do particularly well anymore. And, again, whatever that movie was called, it did give me at least a little bit of background that, you know, it was basically their civil rights, but the extent of their laws, you know, with the way that it was, like, the segregation was going on and, a lot of the just racism that was going on, you would always see some of the people who had, you know, no reason to be affected by the policies because they were white, they would reach across. And when you look at a lot of his following is all white. It seemed like white people in,
right.
You know, concerts when he started coming back in the 90s and he'd have these stadiums fill up with 50,000 people, and they would always say that this is the soundtrack of their teenage years. This was their movement, their, you know, whenever they were doing demonstrations or walkouts in schools or whatever it might have been, you could just see what this, you know, man's presence meant to these people. And the fact that he was alive is like the equivalent of, like, you know how they always say Elvis is still alive?
Yeah.
Like, if Elvis literally came back and held a concert, like, you know, United Center tomorrow or something. I mean, my goodness. And that's what it meant to this region. It was, like, just a spectacular, heartwarming story.
Mm-hmm. The film was called Invictus that we couldn't think of.
I knew it was a Latin word. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so... In terms of him coming back and them finding him alive, I wrote, "What the fuck? He's not dead." was in my notes, and I was really, like, surprised. I was genuinely surprised. And, you know, you mentioned M. Night Shyamalan, and it was one of those where, you know, it wasn't like I felt like I was tricked. It was just I was with these guys, and when they were discovering he was alive, I felt like part of the investigation. And I really liked that, to where it wasn't like, oh, you didn't look close enough. Like, you know, he really was dead the whole time. It wasn't like that. It was like, you know, holy shit, we just found out he's alive. The audience is finding out he's alive. You know, isn't this crazy? And that kind of thing.
Like, it's like the director or the investigators get this huge, like, payoff when they find he's alive, and it's almost like they found a way to share that same feeling with the viewers,
yeah,
telling the story, and then you get to find out, very much to your surprise, that he's still alive, much like the, you know, the journalist did.
Right. Well, one of the things I didn't quite understand, now this is a little off topic, but it's when he's trying to find out more information about Rodriguez, and he looks at the album and it has all of the different names on the album for who wrote the track.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's Rodriguez, and then it's Sixto Rodriguez, and then it's, like, Jesus Rodriguez or whatever. Why do you think that they did that? Like, what do you think the point of that was? Like, 'cause that's something that I never really figured.
You know, I didn't really think too much of that, but I remember thinking, who's Sixto? And then I do remember in my independent research, Sixto came from the fact that he was, like, the sixth child.
Yeah, so that's what they named him, was Sixto.
Yeah, and so that was his first name, which is probably why he just went by Rodriguez. But it still doesn't explain why he would attribute the different tracks, some to Rodriguez, some to Sixto, if he's both people.
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of is maybe he was tripping on some of the drugs that he was singing about, like Silver Magic Ships, like Sugar Man, of course, is like the drug man.
Right. Yeah. One of the other things that I have written down here is I have a couple of just different little things that's from the film here. And the next one I have on my in my notes is when they say an obstacle is an inspiration. And I feel like that is, you know, it's sort of mumbo jumbo, but I feel like that's kind of a nice little I feel like it could be a Facebook meme that people put up and then they put some inspirational picture. Yeah. You know how that's going around, and I kind of like that, especially in this context of this film, because it's, you know, this guy had been met with this huge obstacle of being a failure basically in the United States, but yet he was an inspiration to an entire country of people and didn't really realize that. So I thought that was kind of nice. And then once we actually get to meeting the main character, I thought he was such an interesting guy. Like, I was really taken with him, and I was a little nervous because when they met him, like there, when they started talking about him singing, and when the there's a journalist on the phone talking to one of his daughters, and she says, you know, just between me, you and me, is it really him? Like, is it really that? Is it your dad really Rodriguez? And for like a second, I got this terrible feeling in my stomach and was like, oh my God, this movie isn't going to be a fucking catfish thing, is it? Like, it's not going to go that direction, right? Like, he actually can still sing and he is this right guy. And I just had this like sense of dread. I don't know if it's because of the whole Manti Te'o thing or what, but I had this whole like sense of dread of, oh shit, I hope this is actually the right guy and this is actually on the up and up, and I was really relieved when it, you know, was sort of proven out to be actually him. So,
oh yeah, there seemed to be a lot of conspiracy theorists, especially in the South African media, that were trying to just figure out if this was all a hoax, because it would have, like I said, it'd be like Elvis coming back to America and performing at, you know, mm-hmm. Madison Square Garden or something. It's just so unbelievable, these people, because he is, you know, this icon among their culture, and it's just, you know, that's kind of what I was thinking too. Like, this might not be who he say he is, and they still keep us along with it. I mean, do you remember in the documentary they even do like some graphical reenactments with like, you know, computer generated graphics? Remember where like the plane touches down and the limousines are for them, but they don't realize the limousines are for them. They do some little graphics to, like, you know, kind of depict what would have happened. And they use little shadow puppets, but it was, like, you know, computer animated. It was very subtle. That was just kind of something that I thought kind of helped with that uncertainty of how is this going to go? Like, was the concert going to actually happen? Or, you know, things like that.
Yeah, it's like once that, it's like I felt like I knew where the movie was going, and it was just kind of like this this discussion of what this guy was and meant to this country. And then when he's still alive, I was like, holy shit, you know, I don't know what's going to happen now. And then once he's, you know, he's taken to South Africa, I was like, I don't know if something's going to come up and, you know, he's not able to perform, and maybe, you know, I just kind of, my mind was sort of racing while the film was going on, because I went from being just like a passive observer to being very invested in the film and hoping that everything worked out okay.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe how I was too. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so talking about the actual concert, like once it gets going, you know, and the band describes how he just picked up the mic and finished the song that they were practicing, and you kind of, the fears of him not being the right guy or the guy they're talking about kind of die down. And he is up there and just is so natural looking and just feels so comfortable. Like, he isn't, he doesn't seem shell-shocked or really, it's not that he's not surprised, but he's just, you know, takes it all in stride and is happy about it, but it just doesn't seem, you know, to be, he's just so cool. Like everything's just like, all right, well, yeah, let's do this now. And, but I really love how before that first concert, he says, thanks for keeping me alive. And I was like, that's no shit, because, you know, to all these South Africans, yeah, he was dead, but he wasn't, because his music was still, you know, being passed along to generations and, you know, it was kind of like a nostalgic hit that they all knew and all this kind of thing. But man, I put, what a concert experience this would have been, because the crowd was just eating out of his hand the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this would, you know, even if I didn't know a lot of this guy's music, like that is something that I was envious that I wasn't there for, just for the whole, like the whole experience of it all, I guess.
You could see the energy in the faces of the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think, you know, like we were saying with the whole media not really buying in, I mean, you can believe all you want, but until you actually see the guy in front of you performing, there's still a little bit of doubt, I feel like, that all these people had. And then once he came in and just started belting out I Wonder, and they just lost their minds. So
yeah.
Mm.
Spectacular.
Yeah, I really like that. And then I like that, you know, they do have that little thing at the end where it talks about how he's gone back to South Africa a few times, but he, you know, gives his money away to his friends and his family, and he continues to live in inner city Detroit in the same house that he's lived in the past 40 years. And I just think that that's so nice. Like it's, I mean, obviously that's not for everyone, and that's not a decision everyone would make, but I just feel like watching this story about this guy makes me want to be a better person. Like it makes me want to, you know, it makes me want to sit back and think, you know, I have all of this stuff that I don't really need. And he doesn't need anything. Like all he's wanting to do is just kind of going about his life and sort of, you know, he's now kind of uplifted that he's figured out that he's touched all these people. And I just really, really like that. I just really think that his personality is sort of depicted in a way that he's a person to look up to. And I really like that, even though that could be debatably fictionalized, I like that that's the way that the documentary kind of leaves it.
I remember when he's being interviewed and the person asking the questions asks a question something like, so how does it make you feel that you're like, you know, bigger than Elvis in South Africa? And the response he gives is like, it doesn't make me feel any different.
Mm.
Like you could just tell that this guy is not wired in a way that, you know, the mainstream would be, like an American Idol situation where it's all about jumping and getting a yellow slip of paper saying you're going to Hollywood. Like,
yeah, there's no validation needed for him.
Yeah, he didn't have this Beverly Hillbillies, like, my life is going to change attitude. He just, I mean, he was happy that people were, you know, helped by his music, but it didn't seem like for a minute he ever thought about it in terms of himself.
Mm.
He was always thinking of others, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is it's kind of strange, I felt like, that they interview his three daughters, but they don't ever mention his wife.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I wonder what that's about. And I don't know if that is either them not having enough information or access to where they couldn't really delve into that in a intelligent way, or if it was a – because I believe he's divorced. I think that I looked that up.
Wow, okay. Yeah, I didn't even think of that part of it. Yeah.
And I think that because – you know, I said a minute ago that it's this character that they're giving us. I feel like that they may have left out some of that stuff because they never really, like, I don't ever really remember them asking, like, how he was as a father or anything like that. So I just feel like that the film is very concerned about his, being a musician and what he was doing in the time that, you know, he had supposedly been dead.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not too concerned about him as a person. And so I either think that that's because they figured out that this story didn't need that aspect, or if they didn't really like the results that they found. And so in a documentary, you can shape the film however you want to shape it. And yeah. So that's that kind of cynical part of me thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe he's not quite as great as he is. And, you know, I always want my heroes to have feet of clay. You know, I always am trying to find like that thing that makes them human. But, you know, so I guess I'm a little skeptical of it, but I would love to believe that he's exactly how he's depicted. So I'm kind of torn by that, I guess.
Well, just based on what you're bringing up, it leads me to suspect that based on him getting a degree in philosophy from Wayne State in 1984,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what that does for supporting a family of three girls and a wife. Maybe some of the disputes or the problems that they had were maybe he was just a bit too zen for being a provider, or some of the things that are required. I mean, you can only speculate, obviously. But either the director made a conscious decision to leave those kinds of details out, whatever they may have been, because they're only focusing on his music. You know, it seems to me that would be a logical decision. But it may also have been fair game to also delve into some of that stuff. Who knows?
Yeah, I just think it's kind of interesting that they – you know, it kind of works that they begin the film talking about what a mysterious character he is. And even though they meet him and you get to hear him talk and you get to see him a little bit, he's still pretty mysterious because you still don't really know that much about him. Like, you know what he's done and you know kind of how he is. But I don't feel like I know him much better than I did if he wasn't in the film, because he's just not a real giving interview. You know?
Right.
So I don't know. I just think that's kind of interesting.
And he always has sunglasses on, doesn't he?
Yeah. There's a couple of like when he's doing those performances, he's wearing glasses.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's always got his, you know. And I just think it's funny that he's kind of this old. He kind of looks like this old beat up man, but he's basically like a laborer, like he's a construction guy.
Yeah, he was doing like construction and
demolition, roofing, and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that job's no joke. I mean,
hard work,
that is some hard work and stuff. So, one of the other things that I thought was interesting, and I wanted to mention kind of before we wrap up, is some of his songs are fairly dark. Like it's not a lot of, like, the only real pop song I feel like is that I Wonder track.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest are, you know, very, you know, Bob Dylan-esque, where it's, you know, searching for more than what you have kind of a thing, or, you know, like his talking about losing his job in that Cuz track.
Yeah, Cuz, yeah.
You know, talking about that kind of thing, like, I wonder how it was for him growing up, because it feels like he is writing and singing about a lot of stuff that either disturbed him or shaped him in certain ways. And that's another thing that we don't really get much of, but I feel like he obviously experimented with drugs,
mm-hmm.
but it's, I don't know if it's just like this is a Mexican American in inner city Detroit. Like, you don't need to know much about it other than that, you know, that he got into the, you know, you can kind of extrapolate from there what may have happened, you know?
Yeah. I thought I remember reading a little bit about his family. Because, like I said, I was privy that he was the sixth child.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to say that his father worked as an auto factory worker or something.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know much more about if, you know, there was any abuse or anything like that. It did certainly seem that he had his experiences with disappointment and pain, because, like you say, a lot of his lyrics are not, you know, the looking at the brightest side of life.
Right.
And so it does make you speculate what kind of things he's encountered and what kind of obstacles he's gone through. But I just think that, you know, as you said earlier, that adds to the mystery or the mystique about him, is, you know, even to the extent that you don't ever see his eyes, it's like there's certain things that he kind of shields from the world.
Mm-hmm. I think. Yeah, I think that's good. So, I mean, for those that haven't checked it out, I mean, it is a little harder to get than normal right now because of it being Oscar season. But yeah, check out the film however you can find it, whether it's Netflix or Amazon or iTunes may have it for rent or you know, Hulu Plus or what have you. But do you have anything else that you wanted to say about Sugar Man before we wrap this one up, Steve?
Well, I just want to say, as far as the documentary genre is concerned, there are some other really good documentaries that are worth your while to see. One of them is called Five Broken Cameras, and that one I think is nominated for an Oscar. The other one that I saw recently was called The Invisible War, and that one's rated for an Oscar.
And that one is available on Netflix Instant for those of you that have that.
Yeah. And I just want to go ahead and throw my vote out based on those three. I don't think I've seen the other two,
mm-hmm.
but based on those three, I think Sugar Man, although a less serious topic than Invisible War and Five Broken Cameras, I think is a much better documentary, and I really think should win the Oscar over those other two. It'll be very interesting to see how if Sugar Man ends up taking the win in the documentary category.
Well, there we go. Making the prediction before the Oscars. At the time of this release, the Oscars will have come and gone, but you've got Steve's pick.
Yeah, so mine is Searching for Sugar Man.
You
yeah.
got him on the record. There you go.
Yep.
All right, well, I'm going to wrap this one up. So if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you would like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you can email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show over at Twitter. The show's handle is at plainlabelpod, or you can also follow me over there. I'm at ericwilliams79. We do have a Facebook page for the show. You can find that by searching Plain Label Podcast. You can also friend me over there. And just like our regular show, we are going to have Amazon links on our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com. If you click on the link and buy the movie, then we do get some of that money and it doesn't cost you anything extra. And we are going to have, we'll have the movie, we'll have the soundtrack, and we'll have the first two albums that Rodriguez put all up on Amazon. So if you click any of those things, you can listen to some previews, and if you buy that, it you know, it doesn't cost you anything extra, and we do get a little bit of that money from Amazon, so we would appreciate that. So again, we would like to hear what you think, so write us an iTunes review or give us a star rating, something like that. So before closing this one out, I would like to thank Steve once again for coming on and talking about this documentary with me. If people wanted to hear more from you, where would they find you on the internet?
You can find me on Facebook. My name is Steve Bruns. And also you can email me at my Yahoo account, which is Seinfeld4, but it's spelled Seinfeldfore @yahoo.com.
Well, there you go. Well, thanks again, Steve, and thank you for listening. And I'll be back with another Podshots episode in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.
That's mine. I wonder how much going have you got? And I wonder about your friends that are not. I wonder, I wonder, wonder I do. About the tears in children's eyes, and I wonder about the soul.
soldier that dies. I wonder, will this hatred ever end? I wonder, and worry my friend. Wonder, don't you? I wonder how many times you've been had, and I wonder how many dreams have gone bad. I wonder how many times you had sex, and I wonder, do you know who'll be next?
Cause I lost my job 2 weeks before Christmas. And I talked to Jesus at the sewer, and the Pope said it was none of his goddamn business. While the rain drank champagne, my Estonian archangel came and got me wasted. Cause the sweetest kiss I ever got is the one I've never tasted. Oh, but they'll take their bonus pay to Molly McDonald. Neon lady, beauty's that which obeys, is bought or borrowed. Cause my heart's become a crooked hotel, full of rumors. But it's I who pays the rent for these fingered face out of tuners. And I make 16 solid half-hour friendships every evening. Cause your queen of hearts, who's half a stone and likes to laugh alone, is always threatening you with leaving. Oh, but they'll play those token games on Willie Thompson and give a medal to replace the sun of Mrs. Annie Johnson. Cause they told me everybody's gotta pay their dues, and I explained that I had overpaid them. So overdue, I went to the company store, and the clerk there said that they had just been invaded. So I set sail in a teardrop and escaped beneath the door sill. Cause the smell of her perfume echoes in my head still. Cause I see my people trying to drown the sun in weekends of whiskey sours. Cause how many times can you wake up in this comic book and plant flowers?